The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Harry Bickett is internationally renowned as an opera and concert conductor, and he is especially acclaimed for his interpretations of Baroque and classical music. He is director of the English Concert, the British Period Instrument Ensemble, and he is an accomplished harpsichordist. Harry Bickett joined me in the studio to discuss his remarkable career. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what was your introduction to music, you know, way back when? When did you start playing an instrument?
Well, I came from, funnily enough, quite an unmusical family. I mean, my mother was an artist, so visual arts were a big thing, but music wasn't really. But in a kind of old-fashioned way, my parents thought that children should learn music. And of course, this is back in the glory days when actually schools taught music as part of the curriculum, which I think has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was just always drawn to it. I mean, I would hear something on the radio, any kind of music. It wasn't classical music. Mm-hmm. I just heard stuff, and I'd sit in a kind of trance listening to this music. So I started learning the piano when I was about 3 or 4, and did it all by ear. But I just had a natural affinity for it. But it was never something I was going to do as a career. I never thought I would. And it wasn't really until I was about 17 or 18 that possibilities started sort of showing themselves. And I just thought, well, I could still just do this for a bit and then I get myself a proper job. And I went through my 20s saying, well, I'll just do it for a bit longer, then I'll get a proper job. And then I kind of set myself a target that by the age of 30, if I was still doing music and earning a living doing it, that would probably be what I would do for the rest of my life. But if not, I would absolutely go and retrain and do something else.
Hmm. Wow. So at some point you made the leap then from self-trained pianist to harpsichordist. That doesn't really happen all on its own. How'd that happen?
Well, I think, yes, it's very sweet of you to say that I'm a harpsichordist. I was a keyboard player. I was a pianist. I got a scholarship to the Royal College of Music as a pianist. And of course, like everybody, wanted to become a concert pianist. Mm-hmm. Two things happened. One, I had a slight hand injury. And then I also, I think, began to realize just what the life of a concert pianist was. And was that really what I wanted? Mm. I always enjoyed making music with other people. So I always played a lot of chamber music and I enjoyed working with singers. I loved languages. Mm. So that kind of drew me more into the opera world. Mm. And when I was working at English National Opera in London, I also started working a little bit with the period instrument groups, including the English Concert, of which I'm now artistic director. And I think I was asked by Trevor Pinnock once to come in and play second harpsichord for a big oratorio he was doing, because he couldn't play everything himself. He had to stand up and conduct. And I said, well, I don't really play the harpsichord. And he said, doesn't matter, you'll be quick, it's fine. And I remember the first rehearsal being very nervous, and very diligently I prepared it. And in the break, he came to me and said, no, it's fine, Harry. He said, you can, when you arpeggiate a chord, you can arpeggiate it up, but you can also arpeggiate it down if you want. I went, oh, really? That's interesting. So that was my harpsichord lesson with Trevor Pinnock. And in those days, I mean, the early days of the period instrument orchestras, no one really knew what they were doing. I mean, the string players were just trying to work it out. The woodwind players were certainly trying to play it out, but we were all modern players. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but back then, someone like me could enter that world, because they just needed people that were willing to give it a go. Mm-hmm. And so I carried on. So yes, I do play the harpsichord, but I'm not like someone like Trevor, who's just, yeah. That is his blood.
Yeah. What about this conducting thing? How did you make that leap? Because that's really quite different.
Well, I know. I mean, I do wonder sometimes. I look back and think, how on earth did that happen? Well, I'll tell you that the initial thing was that I was working at English National Opera and on the music staff. So there you do everything. I mean, you play the piano, you're a repetiteur for the rehearsals, you train the chorus, you coach singers, you conduct the offstage bandas in everything, Wozzeck, ballo, whatever. It's a real, trial by fire. But at the end of my time, they were planning to do a Handel opera. Now, in those days, people didn't do Handel operas. Mm. Nowadays, they're quite common, but back then, it was an unusual piece of the repertoire. And the music director of the English National Opera said to me, well, we're looking for a conductor. Why don't you do it? And I said, but I'm not a conductor. I've never conducted. He said, yeah, but you know how this music goes, because he knew I'd been working with some of the period orchestras. And he said, and the orchestra know you, and I mean, it'll just be a one-off, but, you know, and I went, okay, all right, well, fine, you know, why not? Well, it happened that it was Ariadante, which was then a totally unknown piece, one of Handel's great, great masterpieces, and the cast was led by Anne Murray, and, I mean, just an incredible production, which really set London on fire, and that production is still going 25 years later. Oh. It went to Munich, it's been all over the world, and because of the success of that opera, other companies started saying, well, maybe we should look at Handel Opera, because, you know, it's a repertoire that's just sitting there, 40 of these operas sitting there, and maybe there is a way of making them stageable. And, of course, when they started doing that, I mean, Glyndebourne said they wanted to do one, and because I'd had this success, they said, well, why don't you come and do this? Munich said, we'd like to do one. I went to Munich, and that led to 10 years of working in Munich. Hmm. The Metropolitan Opera in New York said, we'd like to do Rodelinda with René Fleming. Would you come and conduct it? I said, well, let me think about that for a second. And I continued to work at the Met. I mean, it was a very strange way through, but I'm quite pleased that it happened that way, because I think often I see conductors, your young people who say, I want to be a conductor, I want to be a conductor, and that's all fine. But you have to really learn your craft. I mean, you have to really do, you know, a lot of diligent work, just learning the repertoire, just learning how it works, how you work with people. Mm-hmm. Most of it is man management, I have to say. It's how you deal with a disparate group of people and try and get them to all pull in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's only something you learn over time and by doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you raise a really interesting question, too, putting it that way, because, you know, I was thinking about the instruments and historical performance practice and all that. And of course, that's very different for a Baroque orchestra, those elements. But what about the conducting? I mean, are the demands of conducting a period instrument orchestra different in any way than, you know, like for the English concert?
Oh, completely different.
Really?
Completely different.
Okay.
Well, because I think a lot of the things that one's trying to do with a modern orchestra in this music is to find a gesture. Mm-hmm. A sound to a certain point, but I'm never going to get modern oboes to sound like Baroque oboes. They're just completely different instruments. And the mm-hmm. same thing with the strings. To a certain point, you can tone it down from making it sound like Brahms. But if you've got high tension strings and modern bows and metal strings, mm-hmm. it's not going to sound like a gut stringed instrument with the best will in the world. So, and also, modern players are very literal. I don't mean that rudely. I mean, they're trained to do exactly what's on the page, exactly that rhythm, exactly that length of note. Mm-hmm. That is in their DNA from the very early days of their training. In Baroque music, I mean, what you see on the page is really a sketch, because performance practice, the conventions of how you performed, were so ingrained in all these orchestras for whom this music was written that the composers didn't feel the need to say, oh, by the way, just swing that rhythm a little bit there if you're in France.
Right.
Just like a jazz player, you put 4 eighth notes in front of a jazz player,
right. They
won't go ba-ba-ba-ba, they'll go ba-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah.
And they don't even know they're doing it, because it's just the style.
Mm-hmm.
So with a lot of modern players, and it's interesting because a lot of them find it very challenging that what's in front of them isn't quite what they play, and that you can't really annotate it.
Mm-hmm.
They often say, well, how long do you want that note? And I'll say, well, it's a fast bow. So and they say, oh, so like an eighth note. Mm-hmm. I say, well, no, I mean, it's the gesture. This is, or if it's with a word with the singer, it's the length of the word. And they go, so like a dotted eighth note. I go, no, don't write it down. Just listen. Just listen and do it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of both liberating and frustrating and challenging that. With a period orchestra, that just comes totally naturally to them.
Right.
I mean, they don't. I never have to mention that. They totally accept that they look at a phrase and they go, oh, that, I think this should be, we should make that that kind of rhythm, or that they can see immediately where the harmony is going, and you know what kind of trill they're going to do. I mean, again, modern players see a trill and it's just brrr, like that immediately, because that's what a trill is in later music.
Right.
And in 18th century music, I mean, there are like 50, 60 different types of trills. With what kind of appoggiatura, with what kind of speed with the left hand, what kind of speed with the right hand, all those kinds of things. You never have time to go into that detail with a modern orchestra, but even just, I just feel like we're pioneers, really. I mean, myself and my colleagues who've been doing this, and the difference in the last 20 years is amazing. I mean, when I was younger and I used to go into modern symphonies doing this stuff, I mean, there would be outright mutiny.
Oh.
I mean, people just thought this was, what are you being asked, what are we being asked to do?
Wow.
This is not the way we learned to play the violin. And now, I think most people have just been worn down by us. And they know that this is coming. But also, I think they've also seen that actually does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the music come alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very challenging, but it's also very satisfying as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was a really good point, too, because certainly the whole Baroque music movement, if you will, has matured in the last half century. And so it really has gone from being that sort of academic, as you say, nobody knew what really was to be done. And now it's really flourished with schools specializing.
Well, I mean, Juilliard has an early music department. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Juilliard.
It's only been the last couple of years, too.
The home of Dorothy DeLay, who, I mean, was probably turning in her grave at the thought that they're teaching people to play Baroque violin. But it's been very successful, and a lot of people want to be part of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You probably have some favorite composers to conduct. I wonder if and they don't have to be Baroque, but who are your favorite composers to conduct?
I also find that question really, really hard. I sort of have favorite pieces, because I never think that any composer, and I'm sorry, even Bach and Mozart and Handel, you can pick every single piece of theirs and say, this is a masterpiece or whatever. I think Carmen is a masterpiece. I don't think Pearlfisher's is.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say Bizet. I mean, it's interesting in my role as music director at Santa Fe Opera that now, I'm going back to my roots from ENO days of doing all sorts of repertoire. I mean, this year we're doing Candide.
Mm-hmm.
I did Romeo and Juliet 2 years ago. I do Rusalka. I do all these kind of, later 19th century and 20th century pieces. And I do tend to, I pick those quite carefully, because I Romeo and Juliet, I think, is wonderful. I wouldn't really want to do Faust.
Hmm.
And I know Faust is a masterpiece. I just, for me, I don't really get it. I don't know what I would do with it.
Hmm.
And I'm in the fortunate position of not really taking on work that I don't feel passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
I really pick the pieces that I feel I can do well and pieces that I feel I've got something to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about listening? What kinds of music do you like to listen to just for fun?
Well, not classical.
Yeah, okay.
And I also have two small children, so I do listen to a lot of children's music these days. I love jazz growing up. I had my own jazz trio as a teenager, early teens. And when I first went to London, I played in a lot of bars to earn a living. And so I enjoy a lot of jazz. My wife has very eclectic tastes, so I mean, I really listen to that. But I have the musician's disease, which is, if music is on in a room, I can't talk to anybody. I literally, my brain just freezes because I can't not listen.
Uh-huh.
It's really, really hard. And so if I hear background music, it's really difficult.
Uh-huh.
Because I just find it difficult to turn off listening to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Little Bird told me that you're kind of a Beatles fan.
Well, I grew up in Liverpool, so it's hard not to be. But even without that, I think I would have been a Beatles fan,
yeah,
for sure. Yeah. Yeah, and even now, it's amazing listening to that music, because, I mean, every single piece of music ever written since then owes a debt to those musicians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That kind of leads to my next question. It seems, this is anecdotal, but it seems that Baroque music has pretty broad appeal for many people, even if they don't have a background or familiarity with the classical music tradition. And I'm just curious to know if you have some insight or some theories about why Baroque music is so appealing.
Well, I certainly think I spend a lot of time doing Handel operas, and certainly those pieces have a lot of appeal. I mean, because they're about things which have really not changed. People always go on about opera plots being complicated, and I agree that you know, Handel is no exception. But really, when he's writing about a plot that's about the king and queen of Bithynia or something, and you know, all the shenanigans, he's actually writing what it means to be a good ruler, or what it means to be in love. And in the same way, the da capo aria, the aria which is in three parts, you have a first part and then a contrasting second section, then you return to the first part again, ABA. That's something that for years people said, it was so untheatrical, and it's so, it's just boring. You just say the same thing over and over again. And I remember working originally, I think, with Peter Sellers, I think it was, and we were just talking about this, and it was really a revelation to me, because we decided that actually, what if this aria is about the way human beings think in real time? So for instance, it's not unusual to say for 5 or 6 minutes, I really love this person, and then to say for 3 minutes, but that person just betrayed me, and then to say for 5 minutes, but I really love that person. Mm-hmm. And when you come back to say, I love that person the second time, it's in the context of their betrayal. So even though you're saying the same words, it has a completely different affect. And that really put a light bulb went on in my head. And I thought, mm-hmm. that is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge, to make those pieces come alive. And when it works, I mean, the thing that people say to me, which gives me the most pleasure, is it's so modern. And also, Handel's music is so direct.
Yeah.
You don't have to speak Italian. You listen to that music, you go, I know what that song's about.
Mm-hmm.
It is like a good pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And Beethoven famously said, he said of Handel, he is the best of all of us, which is really interesting. But he also said, if you want to make the biggest gesture with the fewest number of notes, look at Handel.
Mm.
And it's true. He just knows how to put that chord next to that chord, just like a good pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one. That's the gesture, and that's what makes it work. So I think it's very appealing because it's very direct music. I think it's way more emotional than some people think it is. I mean, there's some people who just think it's this sort of like a Baroque architecture. But to use that analogy, if you go into a beautiful Rococo church, yes, it's got this symmetry, and yes, it's got all this sort of curlicues and, you know, all this gilt and all that.
Mm.
But if you look really carefully, in almost every building, there will be some quirky little thing that just takes it away from this apparent perfection and structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also quite an interesting metaphor, because most people's lives are actually quite messy. I mean, both literally and metaphorically, you know, that we often try to be ordered and try to have structure and symmetry in our lives. But actually, for most human, the human part of our lives isn't quite so structured,
mm-hmm.
and isn't quite so predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that speaks to people.
Yeah, that's really insightful. I've never actually heard it explained that way, but I think that human connection really is the key to it, and that very real kind of experience that the music
absolutely
illustrates. What about the future? Is there some holy grail that you're seeking? Is there something you really, really want to do that you have yet to do as a musician?
Well, I have two sort of big pillars in my life. One is the orchestra, the English concert, and the other is the Santa Fe Opera.
Right.
And so I'm very invested in both those companies in terms of helping them move forward and building on their incredible histories. And that's really exciting to me. So being a musician now, or being a music director, certainly is so much more than just conducting. in the old days, you know, the maestro would just turn up and do his stuff and then leave. And now it's, well, I'm sitting here talking to you, for instance, which is a pleasure, but don't get me wrong. But this is, you know, this is part of what we do every sure. city I go to. And same thing, fundraising, right. you know, all sorts of outreach, education work, you know. And it's good, because in the old days, orchestras were absolutely essential parts of the community, and they should be. And that's what we work very hard to try and achieve. Mm-hmm. So in terms of my ambitions, I'm very wedded to these two orchestras and opera company and orchestra. And really, whatever helps them grow is you know, something I would... I am ambitious for them, and I would help them do that. Mm. You know, would I love to conduct Meistersinger? Yeah, absolutely. Do I ever think I will? Probably not, but that's fine too. You know, I think it's, you know, life is actually very short, and I've already done so many things that I never thought I would. I mean, you know, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, you know, Harry, you'll never conduct at the Met. I just would have laughed and said, absolutely not. Are you kidding me? Of course I'm not going to, you know, there's no way I'd ever have that kind of career. Here I am there every year. Yeah. So, you know, I'm so lucky, partly because I didn't have any ambitions. But, you know, I've just been very, very blessed. And, you know, I get to work with these fantastic companies and make the music that I love with the people that I want to.
What a pleasure and honor to speak with you. Thank you so much for making time today.
My pleasure.